Hello and welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm Katie Helper.
I'm Aaron Matte. Hey, everybody. Thanks for joining us for another episode. It's getting harder and harder to be lighthearted. You know, that's what we try to do with the show. We try to take a light approach to the news as we also discuss serious topics, but it's just getting more and more difficult. It's a very grim time. We have a great guest this week. Norman Finkelstein is here, you know, fan favorite, to give us a very sobering assessment of where things are in Israel's expanding aggression and genocide in Palestine, now, of course, in Lebanon as well. So we're very happy to be bringing you Norman's voice, one of the most informed and insightful people on this topic.
So make sure that you do join us on usefulidiotspodcast.com, where you get the extended interview, the full interview with Norman. You make this show happen. Literally, we couldn't do it without you. And you also get Thursday Throwdown, your midweek dose of media madness, where we try to laugh instead of cry at clips from the media. And as always, we kick it off with our four basic food groups. Democrats suck. Republicans suck. Isn't that weird? Isn't that terrible? And Aaron, you got Democrats suck. So what do we got from you?
For Democrats suck, we're going to turn to State Department spokesperson, former MSNBC pundit, Matthew Miller. Now, we tried to avoid him on the show recently because he's such an easy target. Like, his job is to get up there every single day and justify his government's policy and pretend as if it's doing something to restrain Israel, while in real life, Israel is totally enabled by the Biden administration to commit mass murder, not just in Gaza, but now in Lebanon too. So he's such an easy target that we haven't done him very much recently, but he's had a few exchanges this week that are extremely revealing as he now justifies the U.S. giving Israel the green light to do what it's done in Gaza, to target civilians, to destroy infrastructure in a bid to crush any armed resistance to it. And here is Matthew Miller announcing that the Biden administration, after saying it wanted a ceasefire in Lebanon, now doesn't care about a ceasefire at all.
We support their ability to target militants, to degrade Hezbollah's infrastructure, to degrade Hezbollah's capability. But we are very cognizant of the many times in the past where Israel has gone in on what looked like limited operations and has stayed for months or for years. And ultimately, that's not the outcome that we want to see.
That's not the outcome we want to see. So we're very cognizant that Israel's claim that it's going into places like Gaza for a limited operation, in Lebanon for a limited operation, but then somehow, for some reason, Israel happens to stay for a lot longer and kill tens of thousands of people. And that's not what we want to see. We're cognizant of that. So, of course, in real life, that means that the U.S. fully knows exactly what Israel plans to do, as it did in Gaza. And it's fully on board with that. And this is just a few weeks after Biden was saying that he wanted a ceasefire in Lebanon, that they'd brokered something with France for a 21-day ceasefire. And now we know what really happened, which is that Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, had agreed to a 21-day ceasefire. His thing, though, is he wasn't going to abandon his demand that for a permanent ceasefire, Israel has to agree to a ceasefire in Gaza. And that's why, according to one Israeli official who spoke to NBC News, they killed him. And the Biden administration has given Israel the full green light to not only kill Nasrallah, but basically kill as many Lebanese civilians as it wants to. And that's the other part of that clip. And the first part, he says that, you know, we support Israel targeting Hezbollah infrastructure. He could have said we support Israel targeting Hezbollah military assets, right. But he uses the word infrastructure, which is very revealing, because what's Israel doing in Lebanon? It's targeting Lebanese civilian infrastructure, which Hezbollah also has, because it's not just a militant group, it's a movement. And they have social services, they have clinics, they have paramedics, and that's who Israel's been targeting. And Matthew Miller is saying we're fully on board with Israel targeting that civilian infrastructure, just as it was fully on board with Israel targeting that infrastructure in Gaza.
Disgusting. I mean, there isn't that much to say except, you know, Israel keeps acting like they're trying to protect their citizens. And of course, if they wanted to protect their citizens, they would have agreed to a ceasefire if they're being put at such an existential threat by Hezbollah, right? That's like their whole argument is incoherent and inconsistent, because if these people are such threats, they would agree to things because that's what you do. But they don't want to because it's not about protecting their citizens. It's about a political project.
Exactly. Well, in that press room, finally, one reporter, so fed up with Matthew Miller spinning, he called him out in a really powerful way. And that's my colleague at the Gray Zone, Liam Cosgrove. And watch his exchange here with Matthew Miller.
This administration has financed a genocide in Gaza for the last year, And every day you're up there denying accountability for it. So, I mean, what gives you the right to lecture other countries on their moral?
So if you have a policy question for me, I'm happy to take it. If you want to give a speech, there are plenty of places in Washington where you can give a speech.
Yeah, but people are sick of the bullshit in here. I mean, like, it is a genocide.
You are risking nuclear war in Ukraine for this proxy war. Plenty of other places to give a speech. Go ahead.
Saying how all of us feel, that it's just they're tired of the BS and the spin. And unfortunately, some really horrific news, but not long after this exchange, another Gray Zone journalist, my colleague Jeremy Lafredo, who's in Palestine, he was among a group of journalists who were kidnapped by the IDF, by the Israeli occupation forces. He was beaten, he was blindfolded, and he as we're recording this, he is still being held by Israel. The other journalists who were kidnapped and assaulted by Israel were released. Jeremy Lafredo is still being detained as we're recording this. It's been over 24 hours. I'm hoping, I have to assume that by the time this comes out, he will be freed, because we're talking about Israel kidnapping and beating an American journalist, taking away his phone. And the Biden administration, for all the impunity that it's given Israel, will it really give it the impunity to kidnap an American journalist and beat him? I mean, you never know with Biden.
Right.
But that's also just something that has happened this week. On top of all the other expanding horrors, there's just too many to keep track of. Israel attacking North Gaza, ordering hundreds of thousands of people to flee, ordering them to flee to the so-called safe zone in the south, where already over a million people are living in tents in the worst conditions in the world. And now more people from the north are supposed to go there. Israel's attacking the main hospital, the last one left in northern Gaza that's functioning. I mean, the horror is just impossible to keep track of and impossible to fathom.
It's so disgusting, because, of course, in theory, and Israel claims to be this bright beacon of democracy, but the press and medical workers are supposed to be protected. And instead of taking care to not target them, they are their priorities. Like, they are the people among the groups that they most want to kill. Obviously, for our hospital workers, doctors, nurses, et cetera, it's because they don't want people to be able to be treated. They want the people they injure to either die or be as injured and maimed and brutalized, amputated as possible. And then, of course, they can't possibly have journalists getting the truth out, which is why they have to kill journalists. I mean, I know I'm not stating anything that we haven't said before, but it is so stunning how, like, is there anything Israel could do that would make its defenders wake up, admit that they're not a beacon of freedom, democracy, and, you know, the Western world? Well, I guess they are this great symbol of the Western world.
There is truly nothing, and that's because they're in a cult. And when you're in a cult, you have such fidelity to the cult orthodoxy, which in this case is Zionism and Israel, that nothing, obviously, I mean, we're seeing this in action, a year of this, nothing can shake your faith in the cult and your service to it. And it's dangerous when the cult is populated by the most powerful people in the world, serving a state that has nuclear weapons, and it leaves the rest of us totally powerless. And like, the minimum thing we can do is just observe it and talk about it, but we are powerless right now. And it's, you know, there's no sugarcoating it. It's a really grim moment. It just is.
I didn't know this about Jeremy. I've had him on my show. He's done amazing reporting. I mean, he's done amazing reporting on protests here, capturing all these Israel supporters saying absolutely vile, violent things that, of course, never gets covered by the mainstream media, because it's only Palestine supporters who are portrayed as violent, threatening thugs, even though the violence comes from the Israel supporters. But he captured them talking about how Gaza needs to be flattened, kill them all, et cetera. And he's done amazing work in Palestine and also at the border, filming Israelis literally trying to block aid convoys.
Exactly. Exactly. And I, you know, that has to be a factor in why he was targeted and why they're still holding him as we're recording this, even after they freed other journalists who also were subjected to brutal assault. And it's just, but this is a government that's been given full impunity by the only constituency that matters, which is Washington. As long as Washington gives the green light, as we're seeing, Israel can do whatever it wants.
Well, yeah, and we'll have to add a note. We'll add an update if we do learn anything about Jeremy's latest news. We'll add that in the show notes.
Yes, we will. So what do we have for Republican Suck?
So for Republican Suck, let's take a look at the always informative, always inspiring, sometimes honest and sometimes dishonest, Lindsey Graham. Let's hear what he had to say, pulling together the realities in the United States, where Hurricane Helene is ravaging the people there, and the fight in Palestine.
You can thank Donald Trump and Elon Musk for that. You know, I've been going all over South Carolina like most people. I hadn't slept much. But look what's going on in Israel. Our friends in Israel are surrounded by people that want to kill them, destroy them, a second Holocaust in the making. And Biden says, be proportional. What is the proportional response to people who want to kill you and your family? Gosh. They're running out of ammunition in Israel. We have to help our friends to keep the war over there from coming here.
I mean, it's just so irresponsible and disgusting to have this senator who's supposed to represent the people of his state basically tell people to suck it up because it's so much worse for Israelis, but they're suffering as they, you know, try to wipe out an entire population. Think of the Israelis. Don't think of yourselves, your friends and family who have been killed through this hurricane, in large part, of course, thanks to the climate policies of both parties, but especially Republicans.
I mean, and the racist contempt you have to have for Palestinians to be saying that it's Israelis who are somehow suffering when you have, you know, millions of people trapped in a death camp with nowhere to go, being terrorized every day, being massacred wherever they are, whether it's in hospitals or shelters. Over a million people in Gaza sleeping in tents in the worst conditions on this planet. It was already pretty bad in Gaza before October 7th. It was under siege, you know. Obviously, this is incomparable now, but even before then, it was a concentration camp. But he can't even see them as human beings. So their suffering just doesn't exist to him. And then, of course, he throws in the familiar trope, which you always have to throw in, no matter what the designated enemy is, that we have to fight them over there, so we don't have to fight them over here. You know, I often quoted Adam Schiff saying that about Russia, and Lindsey Graham now is using that for Gaza, that if we don't fight Palestinian babies, which is Israel's main target, basically, over there, we'll have to fight Palestinian babies over here. That's what it comes down to.
And of course, as our guest points out, Norman Finkelstein points out, babies and children, doctors have reported, it's not that they just have shrapnel from explosions that doctors find in these babies and children. They find bullets in their heads and chests because snipers are shooting them. I mean, shooting babies and children to kill.
Katie, you know, you and I discussing this, like, we're not even Palestinian. We're not Arab. We're just, you know, North American Jews. And so imagine what it's like to be a Palestinian in the diaspora, like, or someone from Lebanon watching all this unfold. And then you're living in a country paying taxes to the government that is funding all this, you know, with that elects people like Lindsey Graham to say, you know, we can't be spending money on our own needs here. We have to spend it to help Israel slaughter you know, countless people in Palestine and Lebanon, you know.
Yeah.
Sorry, you know, I'm trying to come up with something thoughtful to say about all this, but it's just so grim.
It really is. Yeah.
It's just grim. So all I can do is sort of like just like express my frustration and emotion, but there's just nothing, you know, it's just words can't do it justice. That's just what it comes down to.
Yeah. And that's something I think about a lot, Aaron, which is that of course there's, you know, the slaughter is happening in Palestine, but I often think of how incredibly demoralizing and upsetting, and those are understatements, though, it must be to be a Lebanese person in the United in the West, a Palestinian person in the West, an Arab person in the West, you know, Lebanese American, Arab American or not, seeing how your people are so dehumanized. It's just built into the political policies and the political discourse in ways that people don't even realize. I mean, it's just so clear that they're putting more value on Israeli life, Jewish Israeli life, than they are on Palestinian life.
And just one more point, you know, because of that dehumanization, it also encourages even more Islamophobia. And this past weekend, I was in London, and at one of the events that I did, a woman in hijab talked about how to come to the event. This was in East London, and she, you know, she wore like a hat over her hijab so that she, you know, wouldn't draw attention to her Muslim identity. And she was talking about how, you know, like many people in her community, they're thinking about leaving the country because they just don't feel safe in the UK anymore. And I suspect that's, you know, that's a pretty universal feeling for many Arabs and Muslims living in the West. And we've seen that, you know, like think of the attacks that have happened against Arabs and Muslims since October 7th, you know, that stabbing of that young boy in Chicago, the young Palestinian boy, the attacks on the three Palestinian young men that was in Vermont, right? That was
Vermont. You know, yeah, they were three Palestinian young men wearing keffiyehs who were shot in Vermont, and one of them is paralyzed.
And we know that, you know, in Palestine, you know, American citizens have been killed. In Lebanon, a man from Dearborn was recently killed in an Israeli strike, and the government just shrugs.
Absolutely awful. Well, we have another clip. Speaking of absolutely awful, we have another clip of Lindsey Graham. And let's hear what he has to say. Let's hear about what his plan is for Israel, the United States, and Saudi Arabia.
Now's the time, if you're ever going to do it, to start a dialogue with Saudi Arabia about the day after.
Right, but the Saudis have also been very clear that what they want in return, that there needs to be a viable, sovereign, independent Palestinian state, which the Israelis recognize.
They want two things. For them to recognize the state of Israel, they want a defense agreement with the United States. Saudi Arabia and the United States would have a mutual defense agreement like we have with Japan and Australia. In other words, the United States would go to war for Saudi Arabia. That requires 67 votes in the U.S. Senate. Senator Blumenthal is a Democrat trying to get the votes. I told MBS a year and a half ago, that will be a heavy lift, but I will try.
But the Israelis also have to want to recognize an independent Palestinian state. They're not going to do that.
An independent sovereign nation called Palestine with security guarantees for Israel to make sure there's no future October 7th. It will be more like an emirate than it will be a democracy. MBS and MBZ at the UAE will come in and rebuild Gaza. They will reform the PA. They will create an enclave in the Palestine that can live in peace and harmony with Israel. They will stop teaching their children to kill the Jews. A de-radicalized, a demilitarized.
Is that actually true? Is that how they teach it?
Yes, literally. So bottom line, a de-radicalized, a demilitarized Palestinian enclave is what Israel wants. And here's the rub. After October 7th, declaring a Palestinian state after the attack would be seen as rewarding terrorism. That's the universal view of the Jewish people. The two-state solution, as we know it, died on October the 7th.
You think it's dead?
I think as it's been envisioned in the past, it is. And I think that was the goal of the Iranians.
The two-state solution was killed by Israel and the U.S., who refused to accept it when it was offered to Israel so many times. You know, I've talked about this a lot in that Piers Morgan appearance I did recently. I stressed this multiple times because it just, it's such an important fact that never gets acknowledged on TV, which is that Israel's been offered for a long time now, going back to the 1970s by the major Arab states, except for Syria, a two-state solution in which it would withdraw from the West Bank and Gaza and allow for the creation of a Palestinian state there in East Jerusalem, which again is a major Palestinian compromise. That's just 22% of the land of Palestine that Israel stole from Palestinians. And Palestinians were willing to accept that for a long time. They made that the PLO made that formal in 1988. But even before then, they were signaling that they would accept that. So if you want to be conservative, at least since 1988, that's been available to Israel and the U.S. But every year, whenever this is voted on at the U.S., it's the U.S. and Israel plus a handful of U.S. proxies that vote no. Back in the 1970s, Noam Chomsky talks about this, there was a resolution along similar lines. The U.S. vetoed it at the United Nations Security Council. So that's been the obstacle to the two-state solution. And if it's impossible, it's because Israel and the U.S. refused to accept it and chose instead to expand West Bank settlements, even during the years of the so-called peace process. So that's what killed the two-state solution. And Lindsey Graham is now exploiting the current moment to say, in line with this longstanding U.S. policy, there won't be a genuine two-state solution. There'll be something called Palestine, a little colony that will be controlled by U.S. proxies, allies, Saudi Arabia and the UAE, demilitarized with even less land than the 22% that Palestinians have already accepted. And there's nothing Palestinians can do about it. That's the vision he's laying out now.
Yeah, it's awful. And of course, he tries to speak for all Jews. He says, you know, it's a universal wish of the Jewish people. Well, not these two Jews sitting right here, for example, and lots of other Jews would also disagree with him. But I love his vision of this, you know, collaboration between two incredibly human rights violating countries, you know, Israel and Saudi Arabia. And I've often said that, you know, Israel is like America's, is the United States's wife, and Saudi Arabia is the United States' like side piece or mistress, because we are public and brag about our relationship with Israel, and we kind of hide our relationship with Saudi Arabia. But another piece of hypocrisy coming from Graham is that he's calling for regime change, and he's being very open about it and explaining the type of government that's going to exist and that he wants to exist. And on the other hand, he's someone who was very mad at Schumer, at Chuck Schumer, when Chuck Schumer was basically saying, not calling for regime change per se, a much less aggressive form of that. He was saying that, you know, Bibi wasn't serving the people of Israel well, and when this whole thing was over, he should be replaced.
Okay, well, let's have a moment of levity in a very, very grim episode today. Let's have one moment of levity at least, and that's with Useful Idiots fan favorite Van Jones, who in a bleak time for our world is offering us a ray of light. And what he is describing is a very courageous move on his part. And rather than tell you what it is, let's just hear him in his own words. Van Jones of CNN, tell us about his defiant act of courage for the world. I was afraid to share this, and this is in a multiple part Instagram post. Okay, Van Jones says, I was afraid to share this, but I've decided to take the risk to share more of myself with the world. And today, on the anniversary of a dark day, I am attempting to light a candle. And he's, of course, I should have mentioned, he's saying this on the anniversary of Hamas's operation against Israel on October 7th. It's not just that my TV role does not always afford me the time to go deeply into the facts. It's that I have often been too afraid to say and share what I deeply feel. Okay. So today, I'm doing something about it. This morning, I started, get ready for it, everybody, my own publication on Substack.
Wow. I cannot believe the bravery required to do that. Wow. And I'm sure the victims of October 7th feel like this is a very appropriate way for him to thread the needle, light a candle.
Oh, yes.
It makes me feel better knowing that those who were killed on October 7th have what Van Jones is doing to memorialize them and immortalize them.
Yes. Honoring,
I'm sure their families are also very moved.
Oh, yes. I'm sure this brings them a lot of comfort that, you know, as they're mourning the loss of their loved ones. Van Jones has joined Substack, everybody.
Yeah.
So, like, what's more galling here? Like, portraying you starting a Substack newsletter as an act of courage, or portraying it as some sort of, like, way to honor the victims of October 7th? You know, that's a tough competition.
Yeah, it's true.
And by the way, isn't it so funny? You remember, you know, like, we've been on Substack for a while, but remember when being on Substack was seen as like being a grifter or like being right wing for some reason, because basically you were basically trying to be supported directly by your audience, as we gratefully are. And thank you, audience, for supporting us. Like, remember back when like we were called grifters or right wing because we were on Substack? Now everybody, now we're in a Van Jones, it's an act of courage and selflessness. So, you know, I guess it's no longer a grift to be on Substack. It's actually an act of courage. So I guess we deserve credit for our bravery.
Exactly. You know? We were trailblazers. We should also credit Van Jones for other examples of real bravery and integrity. I mean, he had the courage to compare wearing a keffiyeh in a Jewish neighborhood to showing up in Harlem with a Confederate flag. So, you know, this is not the first time he's shown a lot of courage and principled commitment and fearlessness.
He's selling himself short to say that,
yes,
you know, this is him for the first time rising to the moment to be vulnerable and show courage. Obviously, when he compared the keffiyeh to the Confederate flag, another courageous and, of course, not opportunistic at all moment from Van Jones.
Yeah. Well, for Isn't That Terrible, we have a really disturbing, just terrible clip of a French Israel supporter being attacked at a pro-Palestinian demonstration in France. Let's take a look at this. Ah! So there you see it, a man who is claiming to be victimized and attacked, and he is attacked, but it's mostly by himself.
I just, you know, like you've heard of that term, like ennui, you know, that, that distinct French male malaise. Like, usually it's French men, in my experience, who have like the ennui, the malaise. And so this is, this brings it to a new level of the ennui of a French Zionist who is self-victimizing among Palestinian supporters, hurting himself, you know, shouldering the burden of being a supporter of genocide by falsely portraying himself as a victim.
Yeah. By just screaming and doing, as nothing, as literally nothing happens. But, you know, this reminds me of, we've seen so many of these things, right? We saw that Jewish lady walking through an encampment with a Jewish thing written on her shirt and literally nothing happening to her. I guess that was honest because nothing happened to her. But then there was another woman who phoned the police saying she was being attacked and trapped by the protesters and she was free and there was no one touching her, asking her, blocking her. Then there's that woman who said that she was stabbed in the eye by a Palestine supporter. And there is footage of it, but it's so clear this person's waving a little flag. Yeah. And maybe it scratches her, but it certainly was not stabbing the eye. And she was fine. She was healthy enough and uninjured enough to appear on the Piers Morgan show, I believe, the day after it happened.
And then there were those two clearly obvious Jewish guys, you know, wrapping keffiyehs around their faces so they couldn't be seen and saying, never forget the 7th of October. We're going to have many more, 10,000 more 7th of Octobers, pretending that they're, you know, Palestinian supporters or Palestinian. They could start like a troop of just people who pretend to be abused and pretend to be Palestinian. You know?
Yeah, someone should do a mashup and we'll play it on Useful Idiots.
Play acting for genocide.
Yep. All right. And those are your four basic food groups. We are so excited to be joined by political scientist Norman Finkelstein, who is a prolific writer and the author of several books, including The Holocaust Industry and Gaza, An Inquest into Its Martyrdom.
And this is a very sobering interview with Norman, not just because we're in a really bleak time, but because Norman offers some really frank words for the state of the resistance. You know, there was a lot of hope that perhaps Israel would suffer a major strategic defeat. A lot of people really believe that it would after it went into Gaza. But Norman, after, you know, so many years of studying this conflict, has a different take and has a really sobering assessment of, you know, what this current moment means for the Palestinian cause, especially in the aftermath of the killing of Hassan Nasrallah of Hezbollah. Now, he also makes clear that he's not judging anyone. He's not offering any sort of sanctimonious point of view on any decisions by these various resistance groups, because it's very easy to judge when you're not living under occupation, when you're not up against this genocidal government that Israel is. But it is important to be as clear-eyed as we can and to recognize, as Norman talks about this interview, where maybe he got some things wrong. And I think this is a really enlightening and informative interview, as always, from a Useful Idiots fan favorite, someone who, Katie, both you and I have learned a lot from. So let's hear from Norman Finkelstein. Norman, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. It's always my pleasure to be on with Katie and Aaron.
We're recording this in the one-year anniversary week of October 7th. So let me just start with a general question. You know, your overall assessment of where things are right now.
I have to enter a caveat before I even begin, which is right now the center of gravity has moved to the battlefield. And I'm not a military expert, so it's very hard for me to assess the current situation. At the political level, it's been surprisingly quiescent. I can't remember a single instance where the Security Council has been so silent, or not so silent, has been totally silent. I mean, at this point, there would have been meetings, there would have been different draft resolutions being circulated. There would be so much activity in the Security Council. And so far, there's been total silence. So at the political level, it's been inactive. Netanyahu, he's, I suppose, an intelligent man. That's what everybody says, and I don't believe in disputing, quarreling with facts. But he, his main ability is in taking advantage of opportunities. He's a politician. In the first place, he's a politician. And he knew, which is correct, that once you entered into the last months of the electoral cycle, all of the media would be focused on the election. Gaza, Lebanon, they would drop to, as it used to be called, below the fold of the paper, of the front page. And so he can get away with anything. So immediately as Kamala Harris got the nomination, if you look, you could see it's very clear. Immediately as that cycle began, the Kamala Harris cycle, Israel was committing a massacre every day. It was just bombing this refugee camp, bombing that school, because it knew it could get away with it. There would be virtually no coverage of it. Even now, let's say if you were to put on the screen, the front page.
As you know far too well from listening to Useful Idiots, the 2024 election is coming fast. And while we can't predict for sure which candidate will win, we do know that either way, everyone else in the world will lose. Unless there was a fun and easy way to make a little extra cash on the whole terrible contest. That's right. Betting's not just for sports fans anymore. Now it's the political junkies' time to shine. We figure that if we spend all our time on Twitter anyway, following the election and endless political analysis, why not put our knowledge to the test? It's MyBookie, a new sports book that lets you bet on the 2024 election from the general election down to who will win each state. If the world is crashing anyway, why not cash in? Don't miss out on this. Pick a side. Use promo code USEFUL to double your first deposit and instantly start with a leg up. Only with MyBookie. If you ask some of our haters, they tell you that Useful Idiots is a secret agent podcast funded by foreign governments. But you listen to Useful Idiots, you know we're American made. And at a time when it feels like most of our money is being sent overseas to fund weapons dealers, we want to show some support for a company that's doing their best to give good jobs to American workers and really good clothes too. It's American Giant, and since 2011, they've been making high-quality, long-lasting, timeless American clothes, including their classic Full Zip, which was named the greatest hoodie ever made by Slate Magazine. From activewear to work fits to the latest fashion picks, American Giant has it all. Check out the premium Slub Crew Tee, the no BS high-rise pant, and the slim roughneck pant featured in Giant Magazine. While most apparel companies have shipped too much overseas, making cheap disposable clothes and creating complicated global supply chains, American Giant stands for simple, local, high-quality goods. It's the kind of difference you'll feel and appreciate for years to come. When you buy American Giant, you create local jobs in towns that help stitch communities together. Get 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com when you use code USEFUL at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code USEFUL.
Page of the New York Times. Top story is the hurricane, then the Kamala Harris Trump, and then the third story, and Gaza and Lebanon is below the fold, as we used to call it. Below the fold meant below the top half of the paper. He knew that he would be insulated from any political pressures, he meaning Netanyahu, he would be insulated from any political pressures for the last couple of months of the electoral cycle. So politics has been absent. The college scene, I think probably students are regrouping and trying to figure out how to move forward after the draconian crackdown in spring, and now the implementation of all of these restrictions on free speech, which make a lively movement well nigh impossible. So on all the fronts, it's been, on the political front, there's been an absence of activity. And on the battlefield, it's very hard to assess. Gaza, as was indicated yesterday, many outlets, media outlets, humanitarian organizations. There was the one-year commemoration of what happened in Gaza. And I think the reasonable conclusion is that Gaza is no more. There's nothing left in Gaza. Right now, if you recall, at the very, very beginning, when Israel first gave the order, I'm talking about October, roughly around October 10th, 2023, when Israel gave the order for the people in the north to go south, and they drew the line, you remember? They drew the line. I said at the time, well, it's obvious what Israel is going to do. It's going to declare the northern sector a buffer zone and effectively annex, the northern part of Gaza. Now, it took a year, but that's actually what they're doing right now. The claim is, which I consider complete nonsense, we're going to clear out Hamas and then we'll let the people back. No, they're not letting the people back. That's not going to happen. First of all, there's not going to be anything left to come back to. They will flatten the whole northern sector of Gaza. That's what they're saying, you know. There's no secret about that. And Lebanon, it looks pretty grim. I think there's no denying that Hezbollah has dealt a very big blow. What will happen? I don't know. I've been listening to all these military analyses, and whether Israel knocked out all of Hezbollah's long-range missiles, whether Israel can isolate the south of Lebanon from the Litani down and just bomb it relentlessly like it did Gaza, and everybody will be wiped out. I'm not a military person, so I don't know. I know that the party of God will fight to the last person, but it's not even clear whether that will be an option, because Syed Nasrallah's stature enabled him to carve out some political space vis-a-vis Iran. In other words, he doesn't just do what Iran says. He was able to assert an independence and autonomy. And now that's not going to be an option, assuming the person that replaced him is in his 20s or 30s, which is what Nasrallah was when he replaced his predecessor, when his predecessor was assassinated by Israel. If it's a young man, he can't stand up to the Iranian regime. And the Iranian regime, it's going to be looking out for its own interests. And it may say, we're going to end all the resistance in exchange for a ceasefire. And then the Hezbollah won't have an option except to agree. So they've lost a lot of their autonomy, I believe. So all in all, it looks grim. What can I tell you? It's the only thing one can do. I had a very close friend, the West Bank, and when the first Intifada was defeated, I asked him, did anything good come of this? Meaning the civil revolt. Did anything positive come of it? And he said, because he was a real political person, he said, the lessons learned. And it's the same thing here. One has to be very sober analyzing the lessons learned. And there, I learned a lot from the past year. I made errors, significant errors in some cases, born of illusions. So trying to figure out the lessons learned.
I'm curious your analysis of Nasrallah's decision to intervene, the position he was put in by October 7th. It seems pretty widely accepted that Nasrallah did not have advanced knowledge of Hamas's operation. Can you talk about what you think compelled him to intervene and how he's tried to calibrate Hezbollah's role ever since, leading up to his murder, which we now know, it's been widely said that Nasrallah had agreed to a 21-day ceasefire with Israel, but he was still refusing to drop his insistence that a permanent ceasefire be linked to a ceasefire in Gaza. And according to one Israeli official who spoke to NBC News, that's what basically led Israel to decide to kill him.
In one of his early speeches, maybe the first or second after October 7th, he was very clear that they didn't know. And you could see, if you read between the lines, he was not happy that they had not been informed by Hamas of the decision to attack on October 7th. And at that point, what's called the axis of resistance would have lost all credibility if it did nothing. If you recall, in those first few weeks, everybody was saying, what is Hezbollah going to do? What is Hezbollah going to do? It was an expectation that in the midst of, at least at the beginning, it was a declared genocide. You know, they muted the language over time, but at the beginning, it was a declared genocide. And Palestine had always been formally a sacred cause for Iran, and as a personal cause for Nasrallah, Syed Nasrallah. He did an interview 30 years ago, and he was asked, I can't remember the exact question, but the response was, if I die, if and when I die, I want it to be for Palestine. It was for him a deeply entrenched conviction and commitment, both at a personal and a political level. He had to do something. On the other hand, as Nasrallah said in his last speech, he said Israel has the technological edge. And they're smart enough to know that, you know, around October 7th. So that was just another way of saying we're not ready for the great confrontation. And so he tried to carve out a middle path, namely lobbing rockets and missiles at northern Israel, not really causing all that much damage, apart from the population had to evacuate. About estimates are 50 to 60,000 people had to evacuate, but not a full-scale confrontation. And if you look back then, by far, by an immeasurable distance, the worst blows were being suffered in South Lebanon. You know, hundreds of people were killed in South Lebanon, including hundreds of Hezbollah fighters. And about, is it 200,000 or 100 to 200,000 Lebanese had to evacuate. Today, the Times showed the pictures of South Lebanon, and it looks like the moonscape. It looks like Gaza. Actually, it looks worse. So he didn't have options. He tried to carve out the path. But I said at the time, if you remember, I said at the time that when people were asking, what do you think is going to happen the day after? What do you think is going to happen the day after? I said, I think we're closer to the beginning than to the end, because I don't believe that Israel will give Hezbollah a pass. They're going to do something. Now, that was only partially correct, because it didn't until the assassinations and then the walkie-talkie and pager undertaking, it didn't occur to me that they were going to use this occasion to wipe out Hezbollah.
You've said that you were wrong about Hezbollah, and I want to know if you could elaborate on what you mean by that.
Well, I'll begin with an anecdote, a germane anecdote. I remember discussing Hezbollah with Professor Chomsky, and he said, I don't believe it's a significant military threat to Israel. And I take seriously anything he says, but I was skeptical of that judgment, especially because they did get at minimum a draw in 2006. So it seemed like they had established their own deterrence capability against Israel. So I didn't agree with that judgment. What I didn't see, because I didn't know, was after 2006, Israel invested a large amount of resources to the showdown, to the final showdown. Hezbollah had that unique characteristic of being very ideological, but also it tapped into the mental resources of the Arab Muslim world. They are fundamentally the fact that every Arab and Muslim is going to be a civil engineer, an electrical engineer. I know Arabs and Muslims very well. They're part of my life at this point. Everyone's going to be a civil engineer, an electrical engineer, or go into something like IT, okay? So you had this wedding, this melding of ideological conviction and technical know-how. And I believed that the ideological conviction was such that they could prevail, or at least equal Israel. What I didn't see, and I frankly have to admit it, and here's going to be a digression, and you'll forgive me, and you can stop me. So my best friend growing
Mark
up was
it was
Mark Cohn. And Mark Cohn was a surpassingly brilliant fellow, for sure. And he eventually became the CTO, Chief Technology Officer, for Unisys, which is one of the large computer firms in Washington and very connected to the Defense Department. And he liked mental games. You know, when we were all out on our bicycles, he was in his room playing chess. He liked mental games. So Mark eventually became the head of the computer system in the Bush-Cheney White House. And he once said to me, he was trying to, I guess, justify what he was doing. He said, you know, Norman, they work very hard, meaning Bush, not Bush, but, you know, Cheney, Rumsfeld, and so forth. And in fact, it was true. They work very hard. If you read the stories about Rumsfeld, Rumsfeld stood at a lectern. He never sat at his desk. He stood at a lectern, and he used to write all these memos, and they called them Rumsfeld's snowflakes. He was always giving the memos, you know? And I didn't get that the other side has his ideological convictions, which are as fervent as Hezbollah's, except they had 1,000 times the resources, because it's the Pentagon, it's British intelligence, it's German intelligence, it's French intelligence. It's the whole quote-unquote Western world, which is invested in bringing down Hezbollah. and eventually Iran, of course. So it was unrealistic that they could withstand the force of a combined and compounded intelligence of all of these organizations. So I guess that's what Professor Chomsky was thinking at the back of his head. You know, how can a guerrilla movement win against the Pentagon in terms of intelligence, you know?
Not intelligence like smartness, obviously, but intelligence.
No, the intelligence community.
And especially also, if I can make a point, that if Israel's doctrine is to deliberately destroy civilian infrastructure as a way to deter its military adversaries, which, you know, Israel is doing right now in Gaza and also in Lebanon. And also if Israel is hesitant to fight a ground war, which it clearly is, and it has the advantage in the air, which it's perfectly content to continue pursuing. I wonder if that's also a factor that puts Hezbollah at a significant disadvantage, because Hezbollah has tried to target military sites throughout the course of its intervention.
Yeah, but the expectation was that if they do not relent in their rocket missile attacks, it prevents the Israelis, Mr. Netanyahu, from declaring victory. And so at some point they have to launch the ground invasion. And at that point, Hezbollah has all the advantages. It has the two main advantages of its home territory, so it knows every square inch of Lebanon. And it has the second, which is not a small advantage. They're ready to die. Right. Israelis don't want to die. Not one of those persons in the Israeli army is ready to die for the cause. They want to go to their nightclubs. They want to go on their trips abroad. Dying for a cause is not on their agenda. Whereas for Hezbollah, it is on the members of the Party of God. They're ready, they're prepared. And at this point, they probably want to, as I believe Nasrallah wanted to die at the end, because otherwise it makes no sense how he died. So that's a very big advantage. But that advantage may not come into play, because it's possible they'll do what they did in Gaza. You know, if you look at the figures for deaths in the Israeli army, it's less than one a day. The last figure they gave out was after October 7th, it was 349 Israeli soldiers killed in Gaza. That's in 365 days. It's less than one a day, because there are no battles in Gaza. This is all a myth. There's no war in Gaza. The moment the media reported each day the conflict under the subheadline, it would be the main headline, and the subheadline everywhere was the Israel-Hamas war, the Israel-Hamas war. The moment they got that subheadline, Israel won the propaganda war, because they were depicting it as a war. There was no war in Gaza. There are no battles in Gaza. You search your memory, 365 days. Do you remember one day when a battle was reported? What they do is they just flatten everything in their path, pulverize it, and then they move in they don't even go into the tunnels. They blow up the shafts of the tunnels. There was no war in Gaza. It's all a myth. That's why, you know, when you hear the talk, Israel says, we killed 18,000 fighters, Hamas terrorists. How would they know? How would they know who they killed? Gaza's Ministry of Health doesn't know, because Hamas doesn't wear uniforms. They don't carry around IDs saying Hamas terrorist. So the Ministry of Health hasn't a clue whether this young male in front of them is Hamas or just was a young male who was walking in the street or in a building. So how would Israel know? It never actually fight Hamas militants. It may see some dead bodies on the ground, but it doesn't have a clue whether it's a militant. Every time you see the Israeli figures, I could predict every figure Israel will produce from now till next year. You know how you know how many are produced? What numbers they'll use? It's very simple. The Ministry of Health releases as total deaths, let's say now they're saying 42,000, right? So Israel is going to say, we killed 21,000 Hamas terrorists. They want to show the one-to-one ratio to prove they're the most moral army in the world, because other places it's 3-to-1 or 4-to-1, but here it's 1-to-1. So all they do is take the total number killed, divide it in half, and say that's the number of militants we killed, or terrorists that we killed. They don't have a clue. There's no fighting going on in Gaza. It's a genocide. I don't care about the technical term, legal term. That's for the International Court of Justice to adjudicate, and law is its own discipline, and how they define genocide is not always the same as the way a layperson or Oxford English Dictionary defines genocide. But I'll just, if you allow me, since I've been writing about this subject, so Oxford's dictionary defines genocide as the murder of a large number of people from a particular nation or ethnic group with the aim of destroying that nation or group. And by that definition, that's what's happening in Gaza. The war is just, it's secondary. Obviously, if you want to commit a genocide, you want to take out the enemy forces because they're an obstacle to achieving your goal. But defeating Hamas is simply a means to an end. The end is to solve the Gaza question. People think this is just a terminological issue, but it's not. It's a question of trying to capture reality. What word captures the reality? If you take Raoul Hilberg's magnum opus, it's called The Destruction of the European Jews. It's not called The War Against the European Jews. Now, there was a book by Lucy Dawidowicz, she was a complete idiot, called The War Against the Jews, about the Nazi, because she didn't understand what it was. I remember my mother, whenever she would hear mention of a war against the Jews, what are you talking about? It wasn't a war. It was an extermination. She said we were cockroaches. They would shine the light on us, and we would scurry to this side. Then they would shine the light here, we'd scurry to this side. We were cockroaches. They were exterminating us. And of course, that image and the appropriateness of that image, because my mother had sensitivity to language, even though English was her several languages, but she knew Latin and she knew the roots and she understood language. That came to mind for me because you see the Gazans scurrying here, scurrying there, go to the north, go to the south, go to Massawi, go, always scurrying. It's an extermination. And wherever they go, they get bombed. Wherever they go, they get bombed. It's an extermination. It has nothing to do with war. So, as I said, the moment it became classified as the Israel-Hamas war, Israel won 90% of the propaganda battle. The only ones who understood what was happening were, of course, the South Africans. They went to the ICJ to say this is a genocide, it's not a war. And if you read their application, they never use language like a disproportionate attack. They don't use language like disproportionate. They don't use language like even indiscriminate. They use the language, they're targeting the civilians. Do you know what a disproportionate attack means? It means you have a military target and you cause what's called excessive damage to civilians and civilian infrastructure. So let's say you want to attack Nasrallah. You want to kill Nasrallah. Does that justify killing 300 civilians, or is it disproportionate? But a disproportionate attack presumes you are targeting a military site or combatants. But that's not what's been happening in Gaza. They're not attacking military targets. If they hit a military target, it's just by accident. It's a statistical error if they hit. It's the equivalent of a statistical error.
If it's military, Norman, you can't even define it as conventional military because Gaza's not a state. It doesn't have a standing army. There's Hamas as a militia with some weapons, but nothing that any functional army would have. So even the term military is not even appropriate.
The combat with guerrilla armies is obviously not something new. And guerrilla armies under international humanitarian law, they're also bound by the laws of war. So it's obviously a very unequal war, but I would still say if it's a guerrilla army, yeah, you can say the laws of war apply. But this is not a war. It's a genocide. I was on with this guy, Richard Kemp. Aaron might know him. Do you know him, Katie?
The British guy?
Yes, he's Israel's main military apologist. And I was on with him on Piers Morgan a couple of days ago. It was a complete disaster, but that's a separate issue. I made the point. I said, look, yesterday, I read this letter from 65 physicians from around the world. They're not from God. 65 physicians who gave testimony as to what they observed. And every one of the physicians, all 65, testified that the children who were coming into the hospital, they had bullet wounds to the skull or to the chest. No shrapnel. It wasn't, bombs and shrapnel. It was targeted bullet wounds to the skull and to the chest of children. What does that have to do with war? They're targeting children. Snipers are targeting children. There's the convent. I've been reading the Navi Pillay UN report on Gaza. And they describe the convent. So there are two women in the convent. They're rushing to go to the bathroom. The snipers killed. They knew they were who the women were because the church, the Catholic Church, had sent all the coordinates and all the information to Israeli officials. They knew who they were killing. They then fired two tank shells at a school for disabled children. There were 54 disabled children who used the school in the convent complex. They fired two tank shells at it. What does that have to do with a war?
Given the fact that basically I think what we're saying is that Israel is willing to kill for an idea or for material benefit, and Hezbollah and Hamas are willing to die for survival, let's say, what they see as survival, does that make armed resistance pointless?
And to hear the rest of the interview, please go to usefulidiotspodcast.com.
Always so great to talk to Norman Finkelstein. His insight is really incredible. And also his honesty in admitting when he's wrong. He's actually said in the past, I think quoting Bertrand Russell, that he likes to be proven wrong because it shows that he's getting closer to the truth. And just so thankful to Norman. And also, you'll definitely want to hear the full interview. So if you're not already Substack supporters, please do become supporters at usefulidiotspodcast.com.
All right. That's been our show. Thank you so much for supporting Useful Idiots and tuning in. We'll see you next time.
Bye, everyone.
Thanks so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For extended episodes, bonus content, and our weekly Thursday Throwdown episode, please subscribe at usefulidiotspodcast.com. Support the show for free by subscribing on YouTube, Rumble, and wherever you get your podcasts. If you like the podcast, don't forget to rate and review. You can also follow us on Twitter at Useful Idiot Pod. Thanks for supporting independent media. We'll see you next time.